right, let's open with a word of prayer. We'll get started here. Lord, we do thank you for your love. We thank you for your goodness to us. We thank you for the forgiveness of sins. We thank you for your aggressive kindness. We thank you that you just didn't leave us alone out down here just bumbling around in the dark, not knowing what to do, but that you were shown into our lives with your word, and your people, and your teachers, and your timing in our life. And we never thank you enough for that. We ask, as we look into your word tonight, that you would open our hearts and share with us what each of us individually need, Lord, at this point in our spiritual lives and our journeys and where we are. So help us to sort through that and to trust you and relax and open our lives up to you more, to your word tonight, and just generally, Lord, that we might take advantage of the beautiful companionship that you offer us through our lives. So bless this time for your purpose as we look at the realities of life as seen in the psalmist's life. In Jesus' name, amen.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing? You weren't here. We called out curses on all the people that didn't show up. Sorry. We'll pray later. We're on the imprecatory Psalms, you know. Pray for the Lord to judge them. You know, we could discuss stuff.
What are you doing?
Yeah, right. That is awesome. All right. Well, it's been so long since we met. God added another 10 psalms on the end of the book, so we've got further to go. So that's
40 years.
That's right, absolutely. You got it, Finn. You got it. So we're on Psalm 5, and what we did last time is that we actually read all the way through verse by verse through Psalm, you know, our little Hebrew thing, and we were starting to go through it through the comments in the back. And we got halfway through with the comments, and we got on the subject of imprecatory prayer. And I had that little handout that we looked at about how you wrestle with don't curse your enemies. But here was David cursing his, you know, calling down curses upon his enemies. And so we were starting to work through that document on imprecatory prayer. And we will try to get through to that tonight. But I wanted to start. We're going to go through Psalm 5 again, but I've got a little different way I'm going to do it tonight, just for memory, for us to remember it before I get into the word by word, is I'm going to read the sections from just an English translation. This is the NIV translation. And then I'm going to read the corresponding in that very, the message, you know, which is that, you know, slangy kind of thing. So you see sort of the point of it a little bit. You'll see how he's worded it very beautifully, but it'll give you, you'll see exactly sort of what the point is of the main section. So Psalm 5, 1 through 3 starts out in the New International Version, says, "Give ear to my words, O Lord, consider my sighing, listen to my cry for help, my King and my God. For to you I pray. In the morning, O Lord, you hear my voice. In the morning I lay my request before you, and I wait in expectation." Remember, we had in there, eagerly wait. You know, we eagerly wait for expectation. And the message is, God, listen, God, please pay attention. Can you make sense of these ramblings, my groans and my cries? King God, I need your help. Every morning you'll hear me at it again. Every morning I lay the pieces of my life on your altar and watch for fire to descend. Now, the reason he did that was because when it says, every morning I lay my request before you, that word in Hebrew is the word that you would order a sacrifice. When you would lay out the pieces for a sacrifice in the temple, you would use that word. So the commentators sometimes will say this is laying out his life as a sacrifice, which is what this guy picked up on. You know, I lay out, but I open my life out, and it's for you. Okay? So that's what's going on with that section. And then the psalmist switches gear in verse 4. "You are not a God who takes pleasure in evil. With you the wicked cannot dwell. The arrogant cannot stand in your presence. You hate all who do wrong. You destroy those who tell lies. Bloodthirsty and deceitful men the Lord abhors." Okay, and the translation here is, You, God, don't socialize with the wicked or invite evil over as your house guest. Dwell, the dwelling word, right? Hot air boaster collapses in front of you. That's arrogant, right? You shake your head over mischief maker. God destroys lie speaker. Bloodthirsty and truth bender disgust you. And that's close to what the word for hate or abhor means in this context. It's more that emotional content of disgust. You know, that somebody is this treacherous. You know, we feel this way about, you know, people that terrorist kinds of, you know, you feel that kind of disgust. It's a treachery when somebody backstabs a friend or something. You know, that kind of moral repugnance is what's going there. Then the psalmist switches back about him. Well, not a word from their mouth can be trusted. Their heart is filled with destruction. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongue they speak deceit. Declare them guilty, O God. Let their intrigues be their downfall. Banish them for their many sins, for they have rebelled against you. And this one he talks about, he focuses upon the destruction. Every word they speak is a landmine. You know, it's got a treachery in it. Their lungs breathe out poison gas. Their throats are gaping graves. Their tongues slick as mudslides. Pile on the guilt, God. Let their so-called wisdom wreck them. Kick them out. They've had their chance. Okay? And then the final section, the psalmist turns back to those that find refuge in the Lord. But let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy. Spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may rejoice in you. For surely, O Lord, you bless the righteous. You surround them with favor as with a shield. And then Peterson has, but you'll welcome us with open arms when we run for cover to you. Let the party last all night. Stand guard over our celebration. See, the Lord is letting the righteous rejoice. He's protecting them from the wicked. You are famous, God, for welcoming God-seekers, for decking us out in delight. Okay? So you can see there's that triumphant at the end. We'll see this in just a minute now that we'll go through it word by word, that there's so much emphasis on the end on joy and delight. In the context of this misery that's happening at the very front, all this treachery, you think, how can you be that jubilant? How can you be that victorious in the middle of all this nightmare? And it's only because of who the psalmist hangs out with, basically, okay? Which is what we'll see. Okay, now let's go back to our syllabus, and we're going to go word by word through that little Hebrew thing that we do. You know, that very first page that's got the interlinear. And again, we're going to have to review a lot of this because it's been so long. And starting at 5:1, remember it goes from right to left. Remember the Hebrew reads from right to left. For the one directing, oh, by the way, just for those of you that I didn't realize until this past week, you know, when they do Roman letters, sometimes how the E's are backward. You know, and when you see inscriptions, the E's will be backward, or some of the letters will be, you know, just they look funny. The A and E will be together, and things of this type. I found out last week that when the Romans when they would do a monument, they would start like right to left, and then the next line they would go left to right. They would go like that, and so when you would flip that around. You know, it would be because you were reading it from right to left, the E's would be backward, right? And then the E on the above line would be the right, in the correct direction because you were reading in the opposite direction. So I had never seen that before until I was looking at a monument in Philadelphia in the Etruscan exhibit at their University of Pennsylvania. So all of Hebrew reads from right to left. They didn't do anything, you know, strange like that on their stuff. So, for the one directing for the flutes, a Psalm of David. That's of course is just the heading, the title in the English. My words give ear, Yahweh. consider my sighing. This is where he starts out with my words. Give ear. He's asking for God to hear him, just like you would, you know, just standard kind of prayer talk. He uses that Yahweh word, remember, which is that personal, that covenant word for God. That's that close, intimate word. Consider my sighing. You know, and he's just basically saying, look at it, Lord. Just, you know, pay attention here to what's happening here in my life, my words, my sighing. Listen to the sound, and the word there is kol, which is the word for voice. Listen to the voice of my cry. In other words, my cry, remember we pointed out, was so strong it had its own voice. You know, it wasn't just listen to my voice or listen to my cry. It was listen to the voice of my cry. My cry itself has this wail. As Peterson said, try to make sense of these groanings and sighings and this pain and these crying that I'm doing here. Hear my cry for help, my king. There's, he uses the Melech word. So he's already used Yahweh. He's now changed and he's saying, now I'm praying to my king, Melech. From, you know, Melchizedek, remember with that Old Testament king of righteousness, King Zedek was righteousness. Melchizedek was the king of righteousness, a type of Christ, an analogy or an example of what Christ would be later. My king, and then he uses, and my God, which is Elohim. So he's used another, you know, government word there. So his king, you got to remember that David is probably at this point the king, right? He's just got a king above him. He knows where he fits in the chain of command. And so he doesn't sit there and have, he doesn't face, whenever he faces if he's a lot like what I'd have to do, even though I don't have an authority like that, I had, you know, areas of responsibility that I would have. And so when something comes up and challenges that and I have a problem with that, I'll say, well, hey, Lord, what are you going to do about this? You're the boss here. You know, I'll actually run and evoke chain of command and say, hey, look, you know, granted, I'm going to have to do whatever you decide to do because it's my job here, but where do you want this to go? And so David, as king over Israel, had this responsibility for being a blessing, a shepherd specifically, to God's sheep. But he knew exactly where his authority and where his wisdom and where his strength came from. It was from his king, right? And so he evoked that. And then Elohim there, my God, that's the big God word, God over all the universe, the title for God. So my cry for help, listen to the sound of my cry for help, my king, and my God, for to you I pray. So in other words, listen, because it's only to you that I'm praying. I'm not trying to work this out myself. I'm starting with you here. Verse 4, Yahweh, again, he switches back to that word. Yahweh, in the morning you hear my voice. There's that kol word again. You hear my voice. In the morning I lay my request before you, and I wait expectantly. So this is the old, you know, we made the joke about, you know, thanking you in advance for your, you know, this kind of thing. You sign a letter, you make a request, and you say, thank you for your cooperation in advance. You know, this kind of thing, you know. And so this is a much more one that, you know, where they say, okay, so Lord, what are you going to do about this? One of my favorite examples, and I have done this any number of times in various shapes and forms over the year, in Israel's history, remember how we have, when they come up and they go into the land with Joshua. And Joshua's good. Then we have the book of Judges. We don't have any leadership. Everything's really, really bad. And then God sends all these judges, and they're nasty folk, the judges. Samson, you know, I mean, they're some really questionable people in the judges. But the last judge is Samuel, which is a good dude. And Samuel is that little boy from Hannah. Remember that Hannah was barren, was being hassled by the other wife. She prayed quietly in the temple. The priest, who was just sort of useless, you know, saw her praying, you know, not saying anything, just moving her mouth, making the, you know, praying silently in her heart. And he accuses her of being drunk. You know, and says, hey, you know, take your drinking outside. You know, you're not supposed to be drunk here in the temple. She said, no, I was just praying in agony of my soul, because I'm being oppressed by somebody that's successful. Because his rival wife, you know, the rival wife had kids and made fun of her being barren all these years, you know, and this kind of stuff. And And then the Lord, Eli pronounced a blessing and said, okay, you're going to have a kid. God has heard your prayer. And so she goes and gives birth to Samuel. And Samuel goes back and becomes the priest that's going to anoint David. He becomes a prophet, a priest, a judge, righteous dude, really good guy, very strong leadership. And David ends up, Samuel, anoints David king, anoints Saul king too. I mean, you know, he's there for that whole period there as they move into the monarchy. The monarchy goes David to Solomon. Solomon has a divided mind. Is he going to worship God or is he going to worship the God of all the wives of the political alliances he made? He's a divided mind. Which way is he going? And God says, I'm going to divide your kingdom. So he splits the kingdom in half. We get a northern kingdom. We get a southern kingdom. There are no good kings in the northern kingdom, ever. Because the day they move up north, they realize they can't have the people, remember, coming south to have the festivals in Jerusalem. You know, once they get in to see Jerusalem, they're going to say, why did we ever leave here? This is great. God's blessing these folks. And so, for a political maneuver, he sets up golden calves, fake priests, a whole counterfeit religion he cranks up in the northern kingdom just to keep his people home. And this obviously was not really, God was not excited about this. Because God had promised the guy, had promised Jeroboam, said, hey, look, I'll make you a dynasty. If you walk before me, just like Saul and David and Solomon, I'll honor this. That's all it takes. You know? And from day one, he says, well, no, I better trust my wisdom rather than trust God. So I'm going to go do the golden calves thing. This is politically expedient. This has worked for people before. I'll do it. And so there's no good kings in the northern kingdom. In the southern kingdom, it starts off pretty good, goes downhill. Every now and then you get a good one. Jumping Jehoshaphat is a good one. You know, Hezekiah is a good one. Hezekiah is one of the last good ones. I mean, and Hezekiah has lost all of Judea. He's in Jerusalem. Almost all of the nation of Judah is being crushed by the Assyrians. Okay, so the Assyrians are coming down out of the north, up above where the Galilee is, where Syria is now, basically. You know, they're coming down with Sennacherib and Ashurbanipal, you know, all these powerful warlords, cruel, awesome military machines. And they come to the walls of Jerusalem, and they send a letter that says, God can't protect you. No other God has delivered their cities, you know. And he just insults God and yells to the people in Jerusalem, don't let Hezekiah trick you into trusting God, because God's not going to save you. So the best thing to do is for you to come out and give up to us and stay here and eat your own, you know, grow your crops and eat your own thing until we come and move you to another land. Because that's the way they destroyed kingdoms. When Assyria brought them in, they would take you and move you, displace you into another kingdom. They'd basically exile everybody. They'd swap all land so all the loyalties were gone. See, you're all mingled. There's no loyalty, so a nation is never going to rise up again to defeat them. And that's the way they just destroyed your culture, your identity, etc. Right? It was a great strategy from that standpoint, you know. And he said, but we'll come and we'll move you to another land filled with milk and honey, you know, and nobody dies in this process, but don't let Hezekiah trust you. Well, Hezekiah takes this letter that's just this horrible letter that's destroying the morale of all his people, and he goes into the temple, it says, and he lays it out before the Lord. He says, look, Lord, at the words of the king of Assyria. They blaspheme you, they discourage the people. This is your problem, Lord. What are you going to do about this? And he just lays it all out there. And I've done that so many times with different things. You know, sometimes I have to write it down. And I go to a prayer time and I'll sit there and, Lord, look at this. Look at this. You know, what are you going to do about this? I mean, this is just right in the face. This is a crisis so much bigger than me. What are you going to do about this? And so the other metaphor that I use there is the psalmist, and it'll be a while before we get there to this one, where it says, pour out your heart before him at all times. It's this image of this hot, boiling pot. It's just, you know, steaming with just heat and, you know, intensity. Let's just pour that out before the Lord, you know, and let it cool and calm down. And And so when your heart gets really like this, that's what I always use, you know, is that image of just pouring that cup of scalding, you know, bubbling, brewing, nasty thing out there. I said, Lord, I need help. Here it is, you know. I remember an exercise they had back in college that was really good. And it was 1 Peter 5:7 says, I think that's the right verse, says, casting all, in the King James it says, casting all your cares upon Him, for He cares for you. Okay, and it's and basically it says, take your burdens, take the things you are worried about, and give them to the Lord because He's worried about you. You know, He's worried about how you're doing. Right, it's that beautiful care thing. And what they had us do in this little class is they had us, you know, separate into the room and take a sheet of paper and write down the things that we were most worried about in our life. All the cares that we had, we just wrote them on a little piece of paper, and then we folded them up, and then we, you know, set them on a table, said, Lord, those are yours, and then we tore them up and put them in a trash can because we weren't going to worry about them anymore. We turned them over to the Lord because He cared about us. So bear one another's burdens, Jesus said, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ, St. Paul. And so God does this for us, and so we pour these things out before Him. And so this is the kind of situation where the psalmist is just pouring his heart out. I'm in trouble here, and I desperately need help. And I'm laying it out here in the morning, but I'm expecting you to do something. I'm not just crying out in pain. I'm also crying out in faith. See, because there's a slight difference between the two. Because there are a lot of people that complain to God, but they don't trust Him after they complain. They don't actually trust, but they don't take the next step. There's sometimes where the worry's so big, where I'll have to say, Lord, I'm worried sick about this. I don't see any way out of this. And I want to trust You on this, but I'm going to have to do like that guy did in the Gospels. Lord, help me with my unbelief. There was a situation where this dad brought his son to Jesus to heal. It was lots of physical and demonic problems. And the guy brought brought the son first to the disciples. Jesus is off ministering to somebody else. Brings the kid to the disciples. They can't help him. They don't know how to do it or something of this type or whatever. And so Jesus now finishes what He's doing and He walks back over. And then the father brings the son, you know, in desperation to him for some healing. And says, if you can do anything, he says what he says to Jesus. If you can do anything, would you please help him? And Jesus says, if I can do anything. he says, all things are possible to him who trusts. You know, I mean, but you never get there without that, you know. And then the father is smart enough, says, I do trust. Help me with my unbelief. The pain is so great, he doesn't have the confidence that faith can give you. Faith can give you a quiet strength, right? But sometimes when the pain is so great, you can't feel that strength. You know, and so you're not sure whether you're really trusting or not. You know, because the pain shouts it down. So you're not really sure. And so I go in and say, look, I don't know whether I'm trusting you here or not. I want to trust you here. You know my heart better than anybody in the world. It's crystal clear that I want to trust you in this situation, Lord, and have a confidence, and that waiting expectantly after I've laid my prayers out in the morning. So if I'm not there, move me forward, Lord. You know, do what it takes inside my life so that I get to that particular point. So this eagerly expectation can be in the midst of, I'm still worried. You know, I'm still really, really worried. But I'm going to hold on at a 10% level, Lord, to Your promises that You'll get me through it. And so you sometimes we're in the middle of that mixed character. Our hearts are always mixed down here of how we're dealing with it. Sometimes we soar triumphantly, 1 out of 100 times, you know. But those are only on the easy ones, I've discovered. The harder ones are a little more difficult. We sit there and say, Lord, you know, I've got to, you know, it's been another 30 minutes. Have I taken the burden back? You know, have I brought it back in? Have I tried to put the little pieces that I tore together? Am I trying to tape them back over and worry over them again? You know, do I need to reassert? Okay, look, I got to remember, let's see, you're the capital G. This is what I use. You're the capital G God. I'm the little G Glenn. This is what I always use, just to remind him who's where here. You're the big G. I'm the little G. Okay, let me remember that and trust you that your resources will either, and like I say, generally the resources work through. Sometimes they don't, you know, and so it's just a matter that I'm not abdicating responsibility. You know, if the answer is then you go charge out there and trust me in the right there. I'm not going to give you the answer before. You just go out there and trust me going out there. You know, if that's the answer, then I'll do that, you know, as much as best I can. So verse 5. For 5 is where he switches, right? He's talking about here, I'm in pain. Help. Here. Listen. Please. I'm praying. I'm going to do this every day, but I have confidence in you that you're going to do something for me. That's how verse 4 ends. I wait expectantly. You're going to do something for me. And part of the reason that he knows this is, and this is how he shifts gear, because you are not a God pleased in evil. In other words, if I were evil, you wouldn't listen to me. See, there's something different about our relationship, and it's not going to be, as it turns out, because he's good. We're going to see in just a minute about this. He said, you are not a God pleased in the evil, and this is evil that's directed toward him. I'm in trouble. Evil is toward me, but I have confidence in you because you don't put up with evil indefinitely. You don't like it. There are limits as to how far you will let it go in your patience and your goodness and your forbearance before you act. So you are not a God pleased in evil. And not with you can dwell the wicked. And I pointed out that dwell there was the resident alien. Remember the person that was not Jewish that could move into the nation and become part of Israel. And they were required to give them land. The Jews were required, the Israelites were required to give them land. And so a resident alien was at peace, even though he didn't sort of completely fit there. And so the wicked cannot dwell even in that sense with God. Not only are they not dwelling like a covenant member, like somebody that calls him Yahweh, but he's even somebody that's at some just general cordial level, you know, peace. You know, I do that. I don't fight you. You don't fight me. That doesn't even work with God. Okay, the wicked. Not they can stand, the ones being arrogant before your eyes. You hate all the ones doing wrong. Remember, we've talked several times about what the problem with arrogance is. And arrogance, remember, creates what? Separation. It creates distance. And distance will, in the ancient world, it was much more important than it. Distance killed you. Distance, separation, when the community did not pull together to keep alive, at survival, subsistence living, where you were totally dependent upon the community to eat, to live, to defend yourself against marauders that came through. You know, if you didn't pull together, nobody made it. And so arrogance that made distance and said, I'm better than you, so I'm not going to protect you. Or if push comes to shove, guess who's number one is going to, you know, I wouldn't consider giving my life for you, you know, because I'm better than, you know, those kinds of dynamics. You know, those are cancerous in a community. They destroy trust. They destroy relationships. And so arrogance is very problematic for God because of the damage that it does to hearts that need to be free. The ones being arrogant and before your eyes, you hate all the ones doing wrong. And the hate there is that active opposition. So when a king hated, it was not a personal thing. The king was not allowed, generally speaking, to have personal vendettas in an ethical society. You know, personal issues, they typically did, you know, for just corruption reasons like they do now, I suppose, you know. But back then, in the ethical things, they were not supposed to show favorites toward their families. They were not supposed to play favorites. I mean, that was the whole point of justice. No favorites, right? No bribery. No favoritism, you know, things of this type, blind justice, you know, they were not supposed to look at those considerations. And so when a king hated something in a kingly thing, it was because it was bad for the community. That was what it was about. It was not about an individual vendetta or, you offended me, or I don't like the way you're wearing your hair, or I didn't like what you said about my brother-in-law, you know, Marty, you know, this kind of stuff, right? And so those were not in this thing. This was, I hate something because it tears up the community. It's arrogant. It does lies. It's deceitful. It's destructive. That's what hate is about. I take an active oppositional stance against it. You destroy the ones telling lies, the man of bloods and deceits he abhors. And I point out, remember, these were felonies and not misdemeanors. These aren't the little lies that, you know, that you recover from. These were felonies. This was treachery. We would call this fraud. We would call this embezzlement. We would call this treason. We would actually call this treason types of, you know, levels of wickedness. And then he shifts gear in 8. But I, by the greatness of your mercy, and remember we pointed out that but I was emphatic, because you don't start a word, you don't start a sentence, you normally start your sentences with verbs in Hebrew. If you put something else in front, it's for emphasis generally. Sometimes it's a little different in poetry to make things rhyme, you know, how English poetry, you know, to make those things come out right at the end, you do some weird things sometimes, you know. They did a little bit there, but they weren't going for sounds. Their parallelism, remember, was in concepts, not in sounds. But so in poetry, it's especially true in prose, but you always watch it when it's in poetry. And this one, but I, by the greatness of your mercy, I will come into your house. Okay? Now, the commentators all point out that he didn't say, by the greatness of my character, I come into your house. He doesn't draw the contrast is not between the wickedness, the evil of the wickedness, and the goodness of the David. You know, he knows better than go there, because he's just talked about the arrogant, I believe. Didn't he mention something about these already? Yeah, and so the last thing he's going to do is get all puffed up about how good he is, and, you know, this kind of stuff going to God. And I was thinking about this over here. I was reflecting about, you know, there are people that are somehow, I suppose, you know, we see images of this in Scripture, people that think that God's going to be impressed, you know, with how good they were on earth and how successful they were and all this kind of stuff. And I ran through in my head just a couple of conversations. I can see, like, you know, I try to think of the most prestigious things in our world today. Those people that are the richest, that have the greatest power, you know, the greatest following or fame. And I can see them going to God and say, well, weren't you impressed? I won 3 Oscars. You know, I can see God look just like, boy, gee, wow, yeah, I'm impressed that you would even be this dull to bring this up. You know, or I'm worth all these billions of dollars, or I own all this land, or I've been president of the United States, or, you know, and I can just see God. Okay, but can you speak a universe into existence? Can you raise yourself from the dead? You know, I mean, and so, these things just don't, you know, what God is impressed by is the heart, the humble heart. Right, that's the thing, the childlike spirit. See, these are the things that he's impressed by, because he's got that same thing, see, and he loves that in us, right? Those, that trust, the openness, warmth, loving, bearing one another's burdens, grieving with those that grieve, rejoicing with those who rejoice, etc. Right? But this other thing about, I remember there was some, I think it was Barbara Bush was speaking at like some graduating class or something, and she made this statement about, you know, the graduating class of the college was going on to careers and stuff like that, and she said, and it's about keeping things in perspective in life. She says, on your deathbed, you will not regret the aid that you did not get in that course, the new product that you were not able to launch, or the work that you did not get done in your career. What you will regret will be the time you did not spend with your loved ones, or the time that you did not spend helping other people, or the time that you did not spend rejoicing in the warmth of community. So that's what you, on your deathbed, as you get older, that's what the issues will be for you. It will not be achievement, fame, success. There were exceptions. There's a story that I'm amazed at, and I don't know whether it's apocryphal. I haven't been able to search this out. But there, the story is told of old Granddaddy Rockefeller, the one that started from nothing and did all this massive wealth building, worked so hard. And they tell a story, and like I said, I don't know whether it's true or not. But he slandered the poor guy for all I know. On his deathbed, they ask him if he could have, you know, he could barely breathe. You know, if you could have anything in the world, what would you have? He said, another dollar. You know, this is how the story is told. You know, and you think, wow, that's amazingly short-sighted, you know, that late, you know, to say one more dollar is all I want, you know. And that's just, you know, like I say, that's not something that God's impressed with, and that's the wrong kind of perspective. And so David, instead of saying, hey, you know, you guys are bad, I'm good, God loves me, you know, God's on my side, he said rather, but I, by the greatness of your mercy, kesed, and that's that word kesed, which is the loyal love of the covenant, when God says, when he pulled Israel out of Egypt and freed them from being slaves in the land of Egypt, to giving, not only being free, but giving them a country. They gave them a land, houses that they did not build, crops they did not work for and plant. They just literally walked in and got this stuff. He said, it's because I kesed you. I have a kesed relationship with Abraham, and you are Abraham's kids, and so I'm going to be good to you because of that kesed. It's loyal love. It's a love that is loyal. It stays after. It grits its teeth. It gets up in the middle of the night and changes those diapers time after time after time every couple of hours. You know, it just stays there when they're sick. It just stays after it. You know, just stays after it in encouraging times and discouraging times. By the greatness of your mercy, I will come into your house, your Beth. Beth is that house, right? I will come into your house. And I will bow toward your temple, the temple of your holiness, in reverence of you. And remember, holiness is that Kadesh word, and holiness just means different. It means separate. Okay? Remember, we talked separate could be bad, but most of the time it's good. But it's a neutral word by itself. Holiness is a neutral word. It just means being different. If you were different from God, it would be bad. But if you were different from just us, it'd probably be good. God says, the reason you are not destroyed, O Jacob, is because I'm different than other humans. Jacob has gotten a lot of trouble. Jacob being Israel, the nation Israel, late in Israel's national life. God has been so patient with these people. So patient with these people. And they provoked him over and over, deliberately over and over. They don't respond to the prophets. They don't listen. Nothing. And, you know, he keeps going, and you don't know how. And he says, the only reason you still are alive today is because I'm not like you. That's who he says. I am Kadesh. I'm different than you. You would have killed yourself long ago. I mean, if you would have taken yourself out. But I have a different kind of heart. I'm long-suffering. I'm patient. I'm good. I will discipline you. We'll get there. We're going to get there. But it will be done in love. It won't be out of just wrath. It will be royal wrath, which is action. You know, action. But it will still be motivated by a love thing. The temple of your holiness, the temple of your difference in reference of you. Yahweh, lead me in your righteousness, because the ones being my enemy make straight before me your way. Now, I put a note out here, is that what the psalmist is asking for there is obvious direction. Once he's confronted, he's got all these detractors, he's got, you know, so treacherous hanging around him, and they're powerful treacherous. These are treacherous, these are people of power, because that's why he uses the image that these people of power, they don't fit in your throne room, O king. People of power try to gravitate toward the king. They try to impress the king, you know, with their gifts, and they, you know, make bribes to the kings and said, well, you know, I'll put some of the tax money in. Remember, we told the story about Haman and the Jews. Remember, he was going to put all the money in to kill Mordecai and Esther. Remember that story we went through, you know, and that's the way things work. That's the way kings got stuff done. You know, people would bribe them, and they would put in gifts to the royal treasury in return for favors and lands and things of this type. And these powerful people that are against the psalmist here, see, they're trying to hang out there with God and represent themselves as representatives of God or powerful or something of this type. And he said, and David is not sure how to act in this situation. You know, it doesn't seem like, you know, how you get paralyzed. You don't know what the next step is. You're under all this pressure. You don't know, you know, if you do this, damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of model. You're not sure what's the correct way to go. What's in so many of our moral decisions, we're not sure what the right thing to do is. You know, a lot of times it's not clear that there are four or five things, all of which have a little right in them and all of which have a little wrong in them. You can see, and it's not clear what to do. And David here, the psalmist, just didn't know which way to go. He said, look, I know if I go wrong, I'm going to be, you know, I don't want to be like them. I mean, I don't want to be on that side of the equation, Lord, and somebody that you're not, that cannot dwell with you. David has always got one foot, you know, hanging over the cliff with evil. I mean, he gets so discouraged at one point, he says, look, I was born in sin. You know, I mean, everything I've done has been tainted since the day I was born. I've done a lot of good, but it's always had this little, you know, shadow with it or something like this. And so I'm not over in this category where I can expect to earn God's approval, which is a good thing because you couldn't get there from here, and that's not the rules anyway. The rules are this greatness of your love. You know, that's the good news. So you go in there and you start out, well, God, you should let me in heaven because of, oh, well, never mind. Okay, come on in. You know, as long as you don't make a case, that's okay. But then it works for God, you know. If you let me in, I'd really like to hang out with you and be around sweethearted folk. Lead me in your righteousness because I got enemies. I need to know what's the right steps to take. I want to do what's right. For you, God, for me, and for the people around me, make straight your way before me. 10. For not from his mouth. Now he looks back at the treacherous around him. For not from his mouth is anything trustworthy. Their heart is destruction. Their throat is a grave. Being open is their throat. I mean, we talked about this. It's just a mixed image there of both foulness and a danger. Just waiting for somebody to step into the thing. And their tongue, they speak deceit. Remember, it's slippery as mud. Remember, this kind of thing. And the whole point there is that these are like, you know, powerful people that make arguments against David. And see, David is probably sick here. I mean, in the next psalm, he's definitely sick, but he's probably sick. And in the ancient world, when you were sick, everybody assumed you were being judged by God. Which means there was a lot of judgment because everybody was sick all the time. That's a separate issue. So when Job had all this misfortune, his three friends came to visit him, and they sat for like one day quiet to help him just to grieve. And then immediately they started trying to get him to confess his sin, to lift the judgment. And Job said, I would love to if I'd done something wrong. But I would be lying if I said I did something wrong in this case. And that would be sin, and then maybe I'd get out from under it. And maybe that'd be good. Well, I just can't do this. You know, and you think, well, you know, I mean, the whole point is about truth. You know, you don't go confessing stuff that, you know, you didn't do. And David doesn't know exactly what to do here. You know, here are these detractors that are sitting there saying he's obviously done something wrong because he's not in the peak of hell, or he's not a bright and shining example today. You know, he's mumbling, he's whining, he's going in the temple real early in the morning, praying a lot. Something's up. Something's up. Something's rotten in Jerusalem. Something's rotten in Jerusalem. And so they're starting to spread rumors. Well, maybe he's done this. Maybe it's time for a change of state. Maybe God's about ready to kick. Remember, we had the same problem with Absalom. Remember, Absalom spread the same things. And then David always wondered, well, maybe it is time. Maybe it is my time. You know, maybe it's caught up with me, something of this type. So David doesn't know here exactly what to do. He says, but these folk, boy, they've really turned their mouths on him. And notice this is by the way, the main weapon in the Psalms is the tongue. The tongue is what always, you know, there are very few people that come after David with swords. You know, Swords are easy to deal with if you're the king, right? The tongues are so impossible to deal with. You know, by the time we get to the New Testament, James, the brother of Jesus, can sit there and say, you know, every beast among heaven and earth has been tamed, but no man can tame the tongue. It is a world of restless evil, set on fire by the fires of hell themselves. Obviously, he's been on the wrong end of some conversations too. But I tell you what, I swear, you go through the Psalms in the Old Testament, that's what it was. That's what it is. It's always people talking, you know, arrogant talk or treacherous talk or slander or something like this. And that word destroys. Just as a word can heal, a word of thanks, a word of appreciation, a word of kindness can just change somebody's day totally. The opposite is also true. The tongue is very, very dangerous. And this is the dominant weapon that's used against David in the Psalms. Heart of them, grave, throat, 11. Declare them guilty, O God. Let them fall by their own intrigues for many of their sins. Banish them, for they rebelled against you. It's funny. That's one verse. Right, he said a mouthful right there in one verse. He says, one, declare him guilty. It's almost like just nonstop. He's trying to talk as fast as he can before he has to take another breath. Right? Declare them guilty, God. Let them fall by their intrigues. For many of their sins, banish them, for they rebelled against you. You know, it's that level of speed. And what's interesting is this is where we got into the precatory psalms, right? And the prayers about where you're asking God to judge somebody and to do exactly this. Right, and this is where we skipped out, and we'll come back to this as we get closer to the end. But the interesting thing I did not point out earlier is that he's praying that God will declare them guilty. Now, and the key word there is declare. They are already guilty. God knows very full well that these people are guilty. It's just that he doesn't get around to declaring somebody guilty until he absolutely has to. Everybody knows he's guilty. He just doesn't want the hammer to fall until it has to fall. He's trying to be patient. He wants them to reflect upon what they've done, come to a change of mind, maybe a change of heart about this. He's patient with us because if he declared us guilty and did the judgment thing, the second we were guilty, most of us would not have lived through the third grade, probably, or the fourth grade, you know, on this basis. You know, it's just... But no, he gives us time to learn from mistakes. And these aren't just mistakes. Remember, these are more, like I said, these are felonies and not misdemeanors. Even felonies. I mean, you look at Moses. Moses was a murderer. He took the law into his own hand and killed the Egyptian, defending the Israelite. Rabbi Saul of Tarsus, who became the Apostle Paul, was killing Christians in persecution. David commits a particularly bad murder of Uriah, you know, in the story of Bathsheba and Uriah. Some of the greatest, I don't want to encourage anybody to do this to become great men and women of God, but some of the greatest men and women of God, I don't know any women that killed anybody, you know. Maybe that's why they're the ones that are called wives in the Old Testament. But God, he waits. I mean, he gives chances even to the worst things we do. There are opportunities. Eventually it comes to a point where we do have to be declared guilty if we don't learn, if we don't change, if we don't go make amends, if we don't fix it, if we don't pay back the community fourfold for what we've done. You know, if we don't go back and try to produce more healing than the damage that we do, at some point he'll sit there and say, this is lost. I mean, I can only let the righteous bear so much destruction from this individual before I have to. There's a break even in there, and I gotta call it quits. I gotta call it quits because I can't let my people suffer much longer. They've done already, and I'll bless them for this. You know, I'll make it up for them for what they suffered. You know, at this hand, right? You know, I'll take care of them for this. But I can't go any further because it's just getting too bad. It's getting too destructive, and so that's what the psalmist is praying for here. Basically, declare them guilty. Let them fall by their own intrigues. Remember, this is reap what you sow. You know, one of the common themes is the pit that they dig. Let them fall in it. what they were trying to do to somebody else, let it recoil on their own head. This is the normal way of punishment, normal way of discipline. You have to learn from them, learn from those kinds of things. That way you learn what it would be like to be the victim. See, if you're going to exploit somebody, you know, and take their land or take their reputation or something like this, and before you get to do it, it happens to you, and you now see what it's like. That has an interesting way of changing you in about half the time, 50% of the time. Sometimes it says, oh, this would be great. If I can get out of this one, I can go do this and not get caught again. You know, that's a separate issue. But it does give you a new level of sympathy for the victims. You say, well, yeah, you know, I'm not sure I want to do that to somebody, actually. You know, I'll pick something else. I'll go, you know, roll their yard or something. You know, or whatever. Maybe egg their car or something instead. For their intrigues, for many are their sins. Banish them, for they rebelled against you. And this was the general method. See, normally when somebody was bad in the community, the way you solved the problem is you banished them. You know, you didn't normally have to kill them. I mean, you normally just exile them. You banished them unless you knew they were going to come back in and, you know, and start back again or kill you as soon as you walk out of the camp to gather firewood. You know, there's some level of treasure where you do a capital punishment thing in the ancient world. You know, there were no prisons at all. You know, there's very little prisons. The king has a prison. He calls it his dungeon. And when a well runs out of water, they turn that into a prison. They throw the prophets down in the cistern and in the mud, like Jeremiah, you know. But they don't have prisons. There's nothing there. You know, you either banish them, you know, and exile them out because they don't fit in there anyway. They're not happy anyway. So go find someplace to be happy. But if you're going to stay around here making us miserable, then we're going to have to deal with you. You know, and there weren't a whole lot of ways of dealing with them. But the first choice is to banish them. You know, maybe they'll be happy somewhere else. And that's what David is praying here, is to banish them. And then he says, in opposite to those, though, that, you know, that should reap what they sow, the consequences of their action, let them be glad, all of the ones who take refuge in you. Forever let them sing for joy, and you spread protection over them, that they may rejoice in you, the ones loving your name. And that's an equally long verse, and it's longer than the other one. So it's got more joy in it. Let them be glad, all of the ones taking refuge. And if you want to look a great refuge verse up, Psalm 57:1 has that word refuge, and it says, I take refuge in the shadow of your wings. You know, and we gave the example of the mother hen and the chicks and the barnyard and the fire. Remember that protected the little chicks. You know, and killed the mother hen, but it was protected under the wings. The little the chickens were under there. And that's the image of God, the mother hen, being a refuge in you forever. Let them sing for joy. That's the second word for joy we had in that one verse. Let them be glad. Let them sing for joy. And singing is a public thing, by the way. So normally when you sing, when you would sing for joy, it was at a festival or at the temple and it would turn into a song. You see, so you would have your own little song that you would sing because God delivered you from this. And you were just ecstatic, you know, that you got through that. And so you would sing. You'd either make a song, and then after David's day, you could hire somebody to write you a song if you weren't particularly talented. You could hire Asaph, or they had some beautiful singers and writers. And so you could ask them to sing, write you a little song. You know, and then sing it in your, you know, for you because the Lord had looked upon me and delivered me, right? And so there were ways to do this. And you spread protection over them. Again, that's that spreading model of the eagle in this particular case. Once taking refuge in forever, let them sing for, and you spread protection over them that they may rejoice. There's that rejoice again in you, the ones loving your name. They delight in your name. Name basically meant presence in the Old Testament, in the ancient world. When somebody said name, it was basically who you were. So they would say, when God said, I will build a temple and I will put my name in that temple, that would basically mean I'll put my presence there. I'll be there in a very special way, and you'll go in there and encounter you. Or he'll pick up a prophet and he'll say, I'll put my name on that person, and I'll have a special relationship with them, and they will be known by my name. They'll be known that this person knows the Lord, or this person is assembled with the temple. So name generally meant presence or ownership in some cases of this type. Then the one that loved the name of the Lord, loved His presence, loved to talk about Him, loved everything about the Lord. And then the last verse has got a great little neat thing to it. It says, for you bless the righteous, Yahweh, as a shield, with favor, you surround him. And 13, when you bless the righteous, that's that word tzedek. And the main thing, one of the things you have to watch for in the Old Testament is that sometimes David will sit there and say, I am so guilty. Everything I do has got tainted. But then he'll say, God, deliver me because I'm righteous, like here. So all the righteous are going to get back. But we've already said, no, the reason that they're getting delivered is not because they're righteous, it's because God is righteous, right? Because of God's goodness. So what you have to do when you see the word righteous, because righteousness can mean either righteousness like I do positive good things, right, and therefore I can boast about it, or righteousness can just be I'm innocent of the things they charged me of. And that's generally what it means a lot in the Psalms, that when it says, look upon my righteousness, O Lord, and deliver me, it's just declare me, and it would just say I'm innocent as charged in the court. You don't have to drag him through all my life and say, you know, and it's not only is he innocent of doing this horrible thing, but he's never done anything wrong in his entire life. We don't have to go that far, Lord. Don't want you to drag out my history, right? And so in this particular case, these are the rejoicing of those that have been falsely charged, you know, but they're innocent, and so God delivers them, right? So when you look at verses about righteousness, you have to ask, is this a positive righteousness, or is it an innocence? So in the case of Christ, when you get to the New Testament, there's this great verse in 2 Corinthians 5, 21, that says, and this is the way you learn how to do this, where righteousness of Christ, and we're going to let the handkerchief represent the righteousness of Christ, all the goodness, perfect, this one's dirty, but hold it here, I'll go get a clean one. The righteousness of Christ, and the righteousness of Christ is that he never did anything wrong. He wasn't just innocent. See? He was positively good, right? He did more good things, more teaching, more healing. He just was awesome in terms of positive righteousness, not just innocence, right? Yeah, okay. And then... And it was so funny when they teach how to do this, you know, I remember one guy would do this. And we're going to let my wallet represent sin. And this is me. All we have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Romans says, right? So this is me, right? And this is Christ. And so so this is the righteousness. And then what is this? No, this is a wallet, but it's representing sin. This is what the guys, the speakers would do. They set you up like that and say, what is this stuff? And everybody in the crowd says, a sin. No, it's a wallet, but we're going to let it represent sin in this particular text. Right. And so he says, in the King James it says, for he, God, made him, Christ, to be sin for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. This is how the verse reads, that because Jesus switched places with us on the cross, right? The psalm, it says, for he, God, hath made him, Christ, to be sin for us. That's what we know about. That we might be made the righteousness of God in him. In other words, strange as it seems, that when God looks at us, he sees the righteousness of Jesus. That's how we get there. Because it's not because we made up for this. You know, we made up for the sin. It's that somebody took that and gave us the righteousness. Only in connection with Jesus that we become the righteous of God. And this is not an innocence. We're not back to the garden. See, Adam was perfect, but he was innocent. He wasn't righteous. See? He wasn't doing good things yet. He wasn't living for God. He was innocent. He was sinless and innocent. But he wasn't like the second Adam, Jesus, who lived with all the temptation of our world and all the pressures upon him. And so this is the beauty of grace, see? This is how we get in. It has nothing to do with the things that are on my ledger that I did. The Scripture says, has this great thing in the Old Testament. It says, in the Old Testament, they would write with the ink, you know, and on those skins. And it says, you trust in me and I will take a blotter to your sins. And I'll dissolve those little ink things and I'll wipe your ledger clean. As far as the east is from the west, so will your transgressions be for me. See? He's never dishonest about us being transgressors. Believe me, it's not an honest thing. It's just that he did this deal so that we have the righteousness of God. And that's where you trust. See, that's where... I ain't got to worry about this, you know. And this is past, present, future. Blessed is the man, it says in Romans, to whom the Lord will not impute sin. I'm still going to make mistakes, and I'm going to do some of them deliberately. I know this. Unless I die in a few seconds, I know I'm still going to be there. But I have confidence because of this. The righteousness of God guarantees my relationship with God, that frees Him up to work in my life to reduce all this, you know, scrape the barnacles off the, you know, the hole. You know, get this stuff out of the stuff. So that's the kind of, this kind of righteousness in Psalm here is just innocence. See, I'm innocent. I'm not positively good. I can't say, God, I have a claim on you. You have to save me because I'm look how good I am. I did all these good things yesterday, so you'd better deliver me from all this evil. Yeah, boy, that's not going to work with the Lord. Because all he's going to do is say, well, you know, according to my records, you didn't bring up the following five things that you thought about so-and-so. You know, the plans that you daydreamed about this, you know. Not you wanted to sort of, no, let's back off. Let's go back to the greatness of your living kindness, oh Lord. Let's go there. Okay, can we go there? So the innocence here, and there's an interesting word here. You bless the righteous, Yahweh, as the shield you favor. And the word favor there is delight or goodwill. But the neat thing here is the word for shield. The shield, there are two kinds of shields in the Hebrew. There's the normal large shield that you would have. So when the kings would make the ornamental shields of, you know, beaten gold, and they would put them up on like the wall of the temple, that's one word for shield. This is not that word for shield. This is the word that's used of Goliath's shield that was so big it required a separate guy just to carry the shield of his armor. It's this magnificently large, overdone shield that God's favor is to us. Right? This just overabundance of provision for us, our care, our protection, instead of just normal protection, you just, you know, it keeps on going and going and going. It's just this gigantic Goliath-sized shield that's known as his delight. And what's interesting about it, the shield is not his power, if you think about it. See, I mean, it says here that, you know, he surrounds, he blesses the righteous, Yahweh, the shield of your favor, you surround him. And the shield, the thing that protects us, is God's delight. See? And that's the opposite of what the arrogant folk up at the front, they didn't have delight. They went in trying to impress God or trying to flatter, you know, God into doing something against David, and all they got instead of delight was what? Disgust. They got disgust. They got probably and disappointment, and then got royal censure if they didn't give, you know, if they stayed with it. But the fact of delight as a protection is that God's always there involved. that he's delighting in the life, being right there to protect and be there and to help and encourage and walk you through stuff and then pick you up when you fall and then, help you when you're attacked. And when you're overcome and he lets you be overcome for different sundry reasons, sometimes growth, sometimes just timing issues and things of his type. Sometimes as an example, he's right there to help pick up the pieces and comfort you in trauma and things of his type. So the strength that the psalmist ends up with, he ends up with, instead of, God answered my prayer and he blew away the wicked, and so therefore I can gloat, right, over my righteousness and that God did my beck and call. It ends up that everybody's having, as this guy said, an all-night party and God's protecting us, while we're celebrating his goodness and relaxing and enjoying one another. See, that's an entirely different outcome than a military psalm, right? Slight the wicked, and then we'll gloat and blah, 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 blah. We're so good and et cetera like this. This is a different, this ends in beauty. This ends in a different thing of beauty. Okay? All right, now, let's go over into the comments. And what we had done on the comments, we had gotten to the top of page 31. In page 31, we had, page 31, we talked about, we got into the issue of the imprecatory psalms and prayers. And see up there, verse 10, the request, is this request proper? Remember, verse 10 is that very condensed one about judge them, let them reap what they sow, banish them. That's the prayer for judgment on the wicked. And the question here, the commentator is saying, is such a request, is this proper? Like most of the imprecations, it asks God to do what he has asserted he will do in any case anyway. Expose and punish sins and sinners due to false accusers, what they would have done to the object of their spite. It leaves the action to God, not proposing to take personal vengeance. And it's motivated by the hurt done to God, not personal animosity. In other words, all the things that David is praying to happen to his enemies are things that God has already said is going to happen to him. It's just that you don't want to get there until you have to. Would much rather this person change their mind and their way of life so they can start helping the community, because we need all the hands on deck. We need everybody planting. We need everybody defending. We need everybody encouraging. We need everybody celebrating. We need all hands on deck. And therefore, it's not to our advantage to banish or kill anybody. So we don't, as a community, want God to judge people a second sooner than it's absolutely necessary for the community. See? And so that's the thing. God's going to do it if they don't, deal with the issue. All right, then go to D. The psalmist expressed his confidence in approaching a God who hates iniquity, evil. An evil person cannot dwell with such a God. People who are presumptuous and boastful, who do not shrink from murder or deceit, God hates and will destroy. They are totally detestable to him. And they should be totally detestable to anybody that's got a decent heart. So you still have, God has mercy on them, pity on them. God at the drop of a hat will accept them if they change. Hopes for the best. But the whole time that they're sitting there victimizing his people, he is not happy about it. He is what we call detesting them and what they're doing. Right? Does he still love them? Yeah. Still committed to them? Yep. As long as he possibly can. Right? He'll stay with us. But eventually, but while they're doing it, he doesn't like it. He just is detestable. In contrast with such wickedness, David did not extol his own virtues. Rather, he stressed God's mercy, chesed, loyal love toward him. By this, he could approach the tabernacle. Okay, E. Evil persons may not enter God's presence. The psalmist, whose opening words indicate his own preparations for entering the presence of God, now indicates the nature of those persons who cannot enter God's presence. God's hatred of all forms of evil and wickedness is such that persons who live by those norms cannot expect to enter his presence. Because God takes no pleasure in wickedness, evil, or evil persons. Evil or evil persons may not be his guest or stand in his presence as the psalmist is doing. God is not merely a God of power with whom powerful but evil persons might hope to stand as guests and companions. God's nature as good and righteous specifies the character required of human beings who desire to sojourn or dwell or be his guest with him. And that's my point about God's not interested in just hanging out with powerful people. You know, I mean, a lot of people that are like to hang out with powerful people hang out with them because they want to be powerful. You know, they like power. God doesn't like power. He likes love. He likes mercy. He likes laughter. You know, I mean, that's who he wants to hang out with. You know, he doesn't want to hang out with people with power. I mean, these, you know, it's ugly. I mean, you know these people, you know. I mean, every now and then we're them. I mean, in some cases where we got nose up, you know, and we do this. And, you know, we feel powerful, stuff like that, and sometimes lord it over others and in different settings and things of this type. But that does, you know, God has no interest in that whatsoever. That just doesn't make sense to live in his town, in his court, in his family, et cetera. It just doesn't fit. Nobody's going to talk to him. We're going to be over here having a party, and they're going to be over there plotting their next conquest, you know, to how to get another dollar, you know, or something of this type, right? So those who live by those norms cannot expect to enter his presence. What's odd about him is that they somehow think they can. That's the weird thing about it. The people that, you know, you get blinded by power, you get blinded by fame and success, and you think you have a right to everything, including God's blessing. And you think it's odd when God doesn't. And so when Jesus starts showing up and all the rich, you know, the high priests that have all the money and all the power, you know, and Jesus is hanging out with tax collectors, you know, this is not right. Fishermen weren't that bad, but he hung out with shepherds, and shepherds was an unclean trade. It was a detested trade. They weren't allowed to vote. They were so nasty. And that I'm jumping ahead here, but that's why God appeared to the shepherds first to announce the birth. Because they were the lowest on the pole. And they were the first ones that he picked for his message, because he does things backwards. He takes the lowly and honors them. But that's getting ahead to how he did Christmas. So, but God picks others. So the women weren't generally allowed to testify in court, except in certain cases. So the first witnesses to the resurrection, who's it going to be? Not the apostles. Yeah, those are just men. He's going to pick Mary Magdalene, Mary, Clopas. He's going to pick the women. They're going to be the first ones he's going to let us see. And they're going to go back and tell the men, and the men aren't going to believe them. And then he's going to appear and he's going to say, why didn't you believe the women? I told you. You know, you don't get it yet, guys. And so God's going to turn it all up in their sorts. It doesn't make sense. It's a dangerous strategy to be arrogant and powerful down here now. This is not something to aspire to. The meek will inherit the earth. And it isn't because the people who have the earth, the powerful people, are going to suddenly give it up to the meek. Believe me, they're not going to be so generous at that time. It's going to actually take some intervention by God. That's when this judgment falls and the world changes hands. And that's a scary day, but that's virtue. But we're not there yet. We're still, you know, thankfully we're working on the mercy and the grace and the patience of God that gives all of us a chance to come to repentance, as it says. Okay, so not a God of power. Then the next paragraph, though evil persons are excluded from God's presence because of their sin, it does not follow that the psalmist is admitted by virtue of his own goodness. We've talked about this numerous times. The psalmist's interest into God's house would be based only upon the abundance of your loving kindness, the greatness of your chesed. That is to say, it was only God's grace and covenant love, as Chesed, toward his people, which made entrance into this presence possible. But those who knew and understood this love of God sought not only to turn from evil, but also sought forgiveness for the evil they had done. See, there's a whole subset of the Psalms where the psalmist will go to God and say, forgive me. I have been the person that I have complained about in the other Psalms. Okay, forgive me. Don't do. And you remember that time where I asked for you to judge them? Let's skip over that. When it comes to me right now, let me go over this Chesed department. And so the psalmist, you can't, you know, take the moral high ground here. You have to take the honest way, the truthful way. It says, as Pogo, in the words of Pogo, I have met the enemy and he is us. Right. This is our That's a famous quote from Pogo the Strip. I have met the enemy, and he is us. But those who knew, like I said, evil they had done. The evil are characterized here entirely in terms of their speech in a manner which illustrates forcefully the potential evil of the tongue. And there's that James 3:16 where it's talking about the tongue. He's got this little, he says the tongue, you know, fire of evil and can't be tamed. And there are a whole bunch of things that James says about it in that. Their words, in the absence of truth, were without foundation or certainty and hence altogether unreliable. They were slandering. The inner emotions and desires of the wicked are of such a destructive nature that their throat is like an open grave, symbolizing death, but more forcefully in a hot climate, an abominable stench. In the pure air of morality, their words create an unbearable smell. Their tongues articulate no truth, but only the smooth words of flattery, which are lies designed cunningly to enable the evil to achieve their ends. With respect to such evildoers, the psalmist can only pray for their destruction. Their thought and words are not only a danger to the righteous, but an insult to God. Now, the point, one thing I want to make there about flattery. See, flattery are, as this guy points out, lies designed cunningly to enable the evil to achieve their ends. So flattery has nothing to do with a person being flattered. It's only a tool to get what I want if I'm the flatterer. It has nothing to do. There's no truth. It's just me trying to get something, and I'm manipulating you if I possibly can. That's what a flatter. That's different than a compliment, a legitimate compliment. And it's so totally different between a flattery, which intends on manipulating you to my personal end, which is some type of destruction or something wrong, over against a compliment which encourages. See? Could be literally the same words, right? And what is so totally different is what I'm trying to do with them. If my intent of the comment, of the compliment, is to get you to approve of me, as opposed to you to get to approve of yourself and be encouraged and do something like that, the same comment can be a flattery as opposed to something beautiful. See? It has to do with what the motivation is. Now, practically, I'll just, you know, lay it out here. We are never 100% this or 100% this. Well, sometimes we might be 100% this. But in every sincere compliment, it's almost impossible not to be aware of how they're going to look at you too. You know, but the compliment, that goes, you're aware of this. But what you always try to do is keep that down below half. You know that's going to happen, and so you know it's going to be, you know, temptation to think about that aspect. That they might treat me better in the future because of this. But that's not why you're doing it. You're doing it because they really did something good. You know, and you want to encourage them, and quality should be recognized. And you know it's, you know, they may try to pay you back with that somewhere later. And the way I look at that is that's a risk you have to take to do the good. In other words, you may get tripped up with it. You may congratulate yourself by how you encourage somebody that day. You may start thinking, oh, this is that's the handkerchief for the good deeds I'm doing. I'm encouraging so many people. Look at me, God. You know, and you sit there and say, well, you know, I know I'm going to be tempted to do that. But still, I'm not going to let the fear of that stop me from doing the good. I'm going to go ahead and do the good. And I'll try to wrestle with how I feel about the way I look and, you know, all that kinds of stuff. But I'm not going to let it paralyze me from taking those risks of doing good. Those random acts of goodness and kindness, as they call them. Okay? So flattery versus encouraging a compliment. The last paragraph there, he does not ask for thunderbolts from heaven. He asks only what their evil might reverberate upon themselves, that they might be tripped up in their own devious schemes and thus become their own victims. And this is the standard way. You know, it's the old, you made your bed, you had to sleep in it. I mean, this was the way the model was supposed to work. There wasn't supposed to be a whole lot of judgments, a whole lot of penal systems and stuff like that. If you know, we're supposed to just sort of get tripped up. If you laid a net out to trip somebody, you were supposed to trip over it yourself when you got up to go home because you had not caught anybody. You know, you were supposed to just recoil back on yourself. If you were spreading rumors about people, destroying reputations, word of that would get around and destroy your reputation. You know, that kind of thing. It's a weak, what you so model is how this was supposed to work. And it was supposed to work so that when it tried on a small scale, when you reap something, when you sowed something bad on a small scale, you learned that you reaped it. You were supposed to say, hey, I don't want to go there again. I learned this reaping and sowing principle. So I'm going to stop this before it gets into something really big. See, if you didn't learn early, then it gets bigger and gets out of hand, and then it gets you, you know, in trouble with the law and with the community and the ancient world and things of this type, right? Okay. One more paragraph on the next page, and then I want to go back through the imprecatory Psalms outline, just hitting the high points, because we're not going to be able to read through all five or six pages of that tonight. But I can certainly explain it, and then we'll need to talk about schedule before we close. Psalm 5, that's on that page 32. Psalm 5 illustrates with clarity the polarity and tension which characterize certain dimensions of the life of prayer. On one side there is God. On the other side, evil human beings. And the thought of the psalmist alternates between these two poles. He begins by asking God to hear him, but recalls the evil persons have no place in God's presence. He turns back to God again, expressing his desire to worship and his need for guidance, but then he's reminded of the human evils of the tongue. Eventually, he concludes in confidence, praying for protection and blessing. But the prayer is not only for protection from wicked persons, but also a prayer for protection from becoming like them. Those who use their tongues to exalt in God cannot also use them to boast and flatter. And Paul and James, in that passage about the tongue, makes the same kind of thing. He says, does the same spring produce salt water and fresh water? No. Then how can the tongue, which blesses God, curse humans who are made in the image of God? He says, you're not supposed to mix it up like that. But the tongue does it all the time. It's that constant threat of danger from this. And so the reality is that I want to focus on God in my prayer, but the tyranny of the urgent, as we call it, the evil of the day, the challenges I'm facing, the hassles, the worries, the things I've done myself that are mistakes that I'm worried they're going to catch up with me. You know, all this stuff is eating at me. And like the psalmist, I go back and forth. Lord, you know, let me pray about these things. You know, I'm going to turn them over to you. And then, you know, a minute and a half later, I find I'm just thinking about these things. And what all the bad things are going to happen. Oh, sorry, Lord. Let me bring it back over here to you again. It's not the same model, but there's a great story and great image that the Apostle Paul uses in Romans 12. And he says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice to God, which is your reasonable service. It's just only reasonable for you to give your lives and your bodies to God as a sacrifice. And he's not meaning, obviously, blood sacrifice and all that kind of stuff on this altar. And I remember one time, the first time I heard somebody, I think it was Nab Clark, make the comment, said, you know, the only problem with a living sacrifice is that it keeps crawling off the altar. Right, we put ourselves up there, and it just crawls off the altar, you know, and then you put it back up there. And so that's why the mercies of God are new every day. You start out every day, like the little Tweety bird, you know, Lord, I'm going to have to get out of bed here in a minute, you know, I want to do good here. And it starts every day anew. And so we go back and forth, and this is a corrective thing, and sometimes it's easy to beat yourself up about it. You know, failure in prayer or failure to do this right, you know. And there is no right here. You know, we stumble, we fall, we get up. God picks us up, you know, and puts us back together and says, hey, no hassle. Don't beat yourself up about this, Glenn. Come on, let's just keep praying. I know you're not praying with the fervor that you did yesterday, but that I don't measure you this way. Precious C.S. Lewis, he's writing about his conversion story. And he's off at like a parochial school. I think it was probably Church of England, Episcopal related kind of church. And he's off parochial school. He's like a fifth or sixth grader. And the way he had understood the faith at that point was that every night you had to confess your sins with enough sorrow to be forgiven. You know, in other words, they didn't have the little, you know, the wallet and the thing. They didn't really, at least he didn't understand that or something of that type. A lot of people don't understand that, by the way. They do think it's confession of sin. Confession of sin has to do with just sort of the day-to-day relationship. You don't have to get married every day to the same person. But you do have to make amends. You know, you do have to clean up the act every now and then, you know, to get along with somebody, things of this type. And that involves confession, but that doesn't get you remarried. You know, those are just getting over, you know, bumps in the road, right? And C.S. Lewis was describing why he became left the faith. And he was saying, because every night I would get in there, you know, and I had to work up sorrow for my sin. You know, and he said, and the devil never let me believe that I worked up enough sorrow for my sin to the day. So I would stay awake all hours of the night, agonizing, trying to work up more and more sorrow. And he says, and on those rare days, rare nights that I knew that I had had enough sorrow, the devil would just say, well, you're not as sorry as you were last night. And so this is that performance trip that religion, and sometimes, you know, religion in the bad sense, puts us on. You know, I got to work, I got to hurry up to please God. I got to do this kind of stuff instead of saying, no, it's God is the one that's the pleaser. He's the one that's aggressive. He did all the work on the cross. Life is simple. I'm there because of that. So it's that trust. It's that beautiful thing where I can sit there and say, I know, I'm praying scatterbrained. You know, there are times I'll say, Lord, because sometimes my prayers, I budget an hour to go through my prayer list, right? And there are days that, you know, things sabotage that one way or the other, you know. And there are days that I'll say, Lord, I got to use the short form today. I just got to go through the headings of my columns here and pick out one or two representative examples. And you know who's on the list. You can read a lot better than I. Sometimes I'll do the list. I say, remember Hezekiah? Here's my list, Lord. Lots of crises, lots of people who need help, lots of leaders who need help, lots of preachers who need help, lots of co-workers that need, you know, this kind of stuff, right? And this is the way we go through that. Okay, so in 2 minutes, we're going to read just the principles on page 41 on precatory psalms. We covered about half of them last time. It should be pages 41 in your book. Has everybody got one? Okay, it's real dense. Don't try to read this. I'm just going to read you the principles and make some illustrated point like this, because otherwise we won't get through, obviously. You know, four pages, you know, small font, single space, you know, et cetera, right? Okay, but the principles of praying for judgment on somebody. The first principle was lead with blessing. This is what Sermon on the Mount's about. Long before you get with judgment, you lead with blessing. In other words, you constantly pray for God to have mercy on them. Pray for God to change their lives, to bring them into life, bring them into change of mind, bring them into joy in relationships, to heal them, to bring them into sweetness. And you lead with that. You bless your enemies and curse not. You lead with blessing as long as you possibly can. Second principle is to be willing to imprecate yourself. This is about evil, not about favoritism. This is where we had an example where David said, if I'm the one doing wrong in this conflict, God, then judge me. In other words, it would be like in the psalmist saying, if I'm the one that was arrogant and such and like this, and I might be, and I may be blind to this, then judge me, declare me guilty, banish me, O Lord. See, this is about evil. It's not about favoritism. This is what the goal is, to clean up evil, starting with you. Jesus said, you know, why don't you take a log out of your own eye before you go try to get the little speck out of somebody else's eye. You know, start at home, try to deal with this. Next principle, most of the time it's about a legitimate means, judgment, to a legitimate relief for the victim. Sometimes it's just about stewardship. Sometimes it's about somebody is being a big bully so long that so many people are getting hurt that it's starting to actually tear the community apart. At some point, you got to judge. You got to say, "That's I can't go anymore because we're responsible." It's a stewardship issue. Sometimes, Lord, the only way we're going to do this, we need some judgment here. We need you to sort through the ones that need removing and the ones that are changeable. Let them stay here, right? But sometimes it's just a legitimate means to get to relief, helping the victim. And this is not where somebody's attacking me and I pray for it. This is where they're attacking you and I pray for judgment for your relief. See, nothing personal about that. This is just about relief for somebody else. Next principle is also sometimes it is for demonstrating to the world that crime doesn't pay. Now here I'm going to read that next that scripture. Help us, O God of our salvation, for the glory of thy name, and deliver us and forgive our sins for thy name's sake. Why should the nation say, where is their God? Let it be known among the nations in our sight, vengeance for the blood of thy servants which has been shed. Let the groaning of the prisoner come before thee. According to the greatness of thy power, preserve those that are doomed to die, and return to our neighbors sevenfold into their bosom the reproach with which they have reproached thee, O Lord. So we, thy people, and the sheep of thy pasture, will give thanks to thee forever. To all generations we will tell of thy praise. In other words, it is judge the people that are being evil to us, so that the world will see that crime doesn't pay. And it'll be a deterrent. It has a deterrent character to it. That if God does intervene in some places and judge people, then maybe some people won't attack us again. You know, free the prisoners. Help us here. And so that's a principle about sometimes it's for a demonstration. It's for a lesson to the world that crime doesn't pay. I'll read that last quote on that page too, by the way. In the Old Testament, precatory prayers typically arise in situations in which the wicked appear to prosper while the righteous are victimized. In this apparent discrepancy between injustice and justice, the honor, majesty, and truth of God are in question. So that imprecatory prayer is a prayer for the breakthrough of God's kingdom and liberation and vengeance. In other words, if you were just watching this on a movie and the perpetrators are always winning and the victims are always losing, then you would never take seriously the claim that God is going to judge you. That God is a God of justice, that He stands up for the wicked, for the meek, that eventually something's going to happen. You would never learn that lesson by just looking at it until you get an intervention. And then you say, oh, well, maybe God does care for the poor and the oppressed and the weak and those that call upon Him and the people who pray and the people who are innocent and the people who are in the right. Maybe there is something to this morality thing. And then finally, the principle of this reap what you sow is also expressed in the Abrahamic covenant as God's job. God promised, remember, Abraham, that says, the nations that bless you, I will bless. Those that curse you, I will curse. So whatever happens to you, if they do it to you deliberately and for moral reason, I will either bless them immensely with blessing if they go in their direction, or I will return upon their heads. That was the protection to Abraham. They said, I'm gonna stand with you, Abraham, and I'm gonna be a shield, a mirror that bounces back to those how they treat you. I'm gonna make sure that they know that you are a special treatment, that every blessing that comes to you will be poured back to them. You know, multiplier, but people that do evil towards you, treachery, that will return upon their own heads and that reap what you sow. So that was a special relationship to try to teach that as we go forward. So that's that's the basic model of how you don't get to imprecatory prayers until the very end. And the things that you're praying for are not really kinds of vengeance things. They're for God to help somebody, help the little people that are under oppression or that are being victimized by a perp. That's basically what the prayer is about. So that evil just doesn't win, basically. Just doesn't win and draw more people to it. It says, well, boy, only the good die young, and to get ahead, you got to do all this bad stuff, and I'm going to climb to the top by stepping on other people, because, boy, look at here, it works. If there were never any judgments or never anything like that, then that would be an unrelieved thing, and the whole world would go in that direction. So that's the bad news. So, okay, schedules. Actually, let's close in a word of prayer first. Lord, we thank you for your love. We thank you for Psalm 5. We thank you for some of the beautiful images in there about the shield so big, your delight, your the shadow of your wings, the safety in your temple, the confidence that we can have on. Have toward you, even when our little hearts are torn up in that emotional cauldron of bubbling and, you know, boiling liquid. We appreciate the warnings about arrogance and pride and things that really do hurt us and hurt those around us. We thank you so much for the time that we've had. We do pray, Father, that we would lead with blessing, that we would make those encouraging remarks, that we would encourage people, and that we would overcome evil with good. But we do pray, Father, for your special interventions in your perfect timing for those that are victims, Lord, that are being victims in innocence, that you would have mercy upon justice in the world. We thank you so much for our hearts and giving us an opportunity tonight to get together, by the way. We really appreciate that. We do pray that you would help us as we move forward in our lives. May we open up more to you, and we thank you so much, Lord Jesus, for taking our sin and sharing your righteousness with us. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, now the schedule, now here's what my thoughts are, and I put this in the email, is that, because this was the only one we got to do in October, the next time I think I'm going to be here, I know I'm not going to be here on the next week, which is the 18th, I know I'm not going to be here on the 25th of October, there's a chance I'm going to be here November 1st, okay, November the 8th, in November the 15th. I don't have those allocated yet, but not that that means a whole lot. But things do start getting a little quieter as I get into November because people hunker down for the quarter end. And then the next 22, the 22nd of November is that Thanksgiving week, and then the 29th of November. What I would like to do is target for November the 1st, 8th and 15th, 3 weeks in a row, figuring that we're going to miss one of those and have to make it up late in November in one of those other things, and try to get three out of those five Tuesdays, one of which is Thanksgiving, you know, the Tuesday of Thanksgiving, which is not a bad night necessarily by itself. Out of the five, I'd like to get three sessions in, and the three sessions I'd like to do would be those Christmas things. Because we probably won't have anything. We might have maybe one in December, maybe. But then it gets busy with the Christmas season. It's hard to pull that off. So November will be the last sort of shot we've got at a sequence. And I'd like to, like I say, I wanted to do four, but I think we're going to have to just settle for three in November, going into the Christmas season. So the goal will be I'll have a completely different syllabus. Won't be in this book. It'll be another little syllabus, but it'll cover background stuff, you know, what happened in the, you know, in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the things that set up, you know, the Roman government, background stuff, so that we'll go through the Christmas passages looking for background hints about the shepherds. Why were the shepherds? What was the whole point of being registered in Bethlehem? What was that about? Why was there such an emphasis upon Jesus being the bringer of peace? What was important about that at this particular point in time? What was the significance of the shepherds being the shepherds from Bethlehem? You know, it's outside of Jerusalem, where the appearance, Bethlehem is very, very close to Jerusalem. And they were a special group of shepherds that this probably were. And they had a special function, and we'll talk about those. I'm not going to leak it until we get there as to what they did for a living. But so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the prophecies of what the Jewish messianic expectations were going into this, so that when Jesus is presented at this temple, you know, as a baby, you know, at the offering there, there were a couple of people that come up to him, and they recognize that something has transpired here. And there's some deep, heavy stuff there as to what things are set in motion. So that's what I want to do, is cover that, you know, what we know about that, and the things that really add background and meaning to the Christmas story as to how significant that was. So that's my goal for those three sessions, to try to do that. We'll target for the first, like I say, check back. I'll know in about 5 or 6 days whether the first is going to make or not, whether I have to fly on the first or the second. I know I'll have to fly on the second, but we'll see whether I have to fly on the first. If we don't, and this is one, by the way, because it's not the Psalms and we won't continue it. If you've got friends, this would be a perfect thing to ask them to come to if they'd be interested in this kind of stuff. So we'll resume Psalms probably in the January time frame up through February, and then we'll have a similar three or four things about Easter, the Passover, the stuff going into the last week of Jesus' life before we get to Easter, whenever it is this year.